All right, everybody, we can be turning, if you would, go to Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59, and we're going to go to verse 21, last verse in the passage. As for me, this is my covenant with them, saith the Lord. My spirit is upon thee, and my words which I have put in thy mouth shall not depart out of thy mouth, nor out of the mouth of thy seed, nor out of the mouth of thy seed's seed, saith the Lord, from henceforth and forever. It's a pretty powerful statement there, that what he says he absolutely intends to keep. His very words will never depart. And Jesus Christ makes a very similar statement, where he says in Mark 13:31, where he said, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words, the individual W-O-R-D-S that I speak, shall never pass away. When people believe in the new Bibles and all that, you ask them, well, where are the words of God? He said they'd never pass away, they'd always be there. And for whatever reason, 150 years ago, people began to change and say, well, he never promised to keep every word. Oh, he's just going to keep some of them, the gist of what he said or whatever. And it's amazing how many people bought that. And to the great destruction of Christianity, the great destruction of the English and Western speaking countries and such. But I go into that just to say this. What God says is sacred to him. And if you have any sense, what you say is sacred to you. Okay, what if I were to say, for example, you know, Neil Ford's a great guy and a lot of fun to be around, but you have to take what he says with a grain of salt. Well, what did I just basically say? You can't trust him, okay? That's an insult. Oh, Neil told you that? Well, you know, how would you like that to be your reputation? And I know people who have earned that reputation, and if you ever have, it takes a long time to dis-earn that reputation, to earn one where people know that what you say you mean, okay? So when people say, well, God is really great, but he didn't keep his word. What? What do you mean? Well, you can't trust everything that it says here. Well, he promised that every single word he ever said would be kept. He told the disciples, he said, and the Comforter, which is the Holy Ghost, shall come upon you, and he shall teach you all things, bringing to remembrance whatsoever I have said unto you. So Mark might be sitting there, John might be sitting there, Luke might be sitting there, Matthew might be sitting there, and each thinking about a particular day, each one of them is promised perfect recall for what Jesus Christ said. Number two, they're promised to be given understanding of it. It's oftentimes why things are recorded differently, because if you go ahead and give a set of instructions, for example, I've already talked two or three times about how we're going to take two offerings for the next 5 weeks. I've said that back with the elders, I've talked to my family about it, and I've talked to it in the church. Well, each one might record that, and yet how I said it might be a little different each time, okay? Does that mean that one of us is wrong? No. In other words, I said it three times and each one recorded it differently. And that's the way it is with Jesus Christ. Things that he'll say, they've recorded. But the other thing is, they were given that understanding. It says, and the Holy Ghost will teach them all things. And so when Paul gives his opinion on something, John gives his opinion on something, you'd be sure of one thing, it's God's opinion. It's what God believes about it. Now, what I want to do here, 2 weeks ago, I talked about this idea of pointing out what prophecy really is. If I prophesy, I think in the upcoming election that there will be a lot of vomit on election floors, you know. And you know, and I actually got that from a cartoon. It shows two election watchers, and there's a guy bombing into a trash can, and they're saying, "We still can't tell if he voted Democrat or Republican." But the thing is, regardless of all that, it would be me as the best I can, knowing what I do about life and such, trying to predict which way something will go. You know something? At 62, I'm marginally better than I was at 18. Marginally. It's still, there's too much going on in life for you to ever really figure out what's going to go on, all right? Now, if I take something of my wife's, put it in the wrong place, it doesn't take a lot of prophetic talent to know what's going to happen when she walks in. Get down! All right, it's going to be bad, all right? And, you know, my boys all have a thing. You know, Sam last night, you know, she's, "Sam, are you going to chew me out for what Tim did?" "Bam, I'm up." No, all right, I'll just listen. All right, I know it's Tim that did it, but go ahead, I'll listen. You know, and he knows. He doesn't even begin to try to stop her. She's wound up and it's going to go. All right? You know, and there's that form of prophecy where you kind of figure out ahead of time. But, you know, it's not real accurate. God doesn't use that kind of prophecy. He could. He could say to himself, "Well, you know, when Chris goes home, we know he's a little tired, he'll lay down for a nap, but then Jody will at this time wake him up. He'll be a little grumpy with Jody, and then Zane will run outside when he's not supposed." And you know, and he can kind of look and see as the dominoes fall over which way they go. He's God, he could do that, but that is not how God prophesies. When God prophesies, he is ordering history to go the way he tells it to go. Pastor Hayne and I laugh because I always call his little appointment book his book of prophecy. And the first time I called it that, what do you call it that for? "Well, it tells you where you're going to be." You know, in other words, if we have a meeting with so-and-so a day, it's your book of prophecy. You can prophesy. You'll be at the so-and-so meeting on that day. And he laughs over that. But the difference between Pastor Hayne and God is he can't force the events to go the way he wants. He can't stop his wife from getting ill, if it's raining, or whatever else it happens. But it gives you the idea, if you were to write an appointment calendar, it becomes a book of prophecy in the sense you will try to be at each of those appointments. You will try to make it come to pass exactly as it said. What you don't have is the power of God to make that happen. Okay. Now, with that in mind, go to Matthew chapter 1. Okay, Matthew chapter 1. Look at verse 20. "But while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a dream, saying, Joseph, thou son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Ghost. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now all this was done, why? That it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, Behold, a virgin shall be with child, and he shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which is being interpreted, God with us." So why did the Lord come to Joseph? It tells you why he did. Why did he tell him that stuff? He did it so that it would be fulfilled. In other words, it's not that God figured out that one day this is going to happen and wrote it down. When the time came, God saw to it it happened because he'd ordered it to happen in prophecy. Now, I want to show you that a little bit more clearly. Go to Isaiah chapter 9, right after the biggest book after the book of Psalms, first big book after Psalms, Isaiah chapter 9. You have Psalms, Proverbs, a couple little books, and Isaiah 9. And we'll go to verse 1. Mm. Nevertheless, the dimness shall not be as such was in her vexation, when at the first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward did more grievously afflict her beyond the way of the sea, beyond Jordan and Galilee of the nations. Look at verse 2. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light, and they that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shine. Now, I want to show you that being fulfilled. Go back to Matthew 4, and we're going to see that fulfilled. Go to verse 12, Matthew chapter 4, verse 12. Now when Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, he departed into Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the sea coast, in the borders of Zebulun and Naphtali. Why did he do that? Verse 14, that it might be fulfilled that which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond Jordan, Galilee of the nations, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people which sat in darkness saw great light, and to them which sat in the region in the shadow of death, light is sprung up. First of all, what's the light they saw? They saw Jesus, okay? But the thing is, why did Jesus go to Galilee and walk through those two lands? It tells you why. He did it so that the prophecy would be fulfilled. It says so. Look what it says. Why did he do it? Verse 14. That it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet. In other words, Jesus looked at his watch, looked at the calendar, checked his, his with Apple schedule and everything else, and said to himself, all right, it's time now for me to walk through Zebulun and Naphtali. It's time for me to go do that. It's written that I'll do it. I must do it. I must obey the word of God. And he walks to that land, and people see a ruddy Jew and don't realize a prophecy is being fulfilled here. We're seeing actually a great light. We're seeing the very Son of God. They didn't realize that. Maybe some did, some didn't. But why is he walking through there? It tells you why, that it might be fulfilled. That's why he did it. Okay. Now, go to Isaiah 42. We're going back and forth here. Isaiah 42. We're going to be in verse 1. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and a smoking flax shall he not quench. He shall bring forth judgment unto truth. Okay, so that's a prophecy about Jesus Christ. Now let's watch it fulfilled. Go to Matthew chapter 12. Verse 14. Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him. And by the way, from time to time, there will be people who get upset with you and think they need to destroy you. I don't care who you are. That's just part of life. Sometimes it'll be family members. Sometimes it'll be friends. But when that happens, what's important is that you remember meekness. What does that mean? Don't get involved defending yourself. Okay? Almost all the worst mistakes I have ever made in life have been defending myself. Usually, in fact, if I get defensive, I'm always ashamed of what I say afterwards. Later on, I'll look back and wish I had not said that. I'll look back and realize what an idiot you made of yourself. Well, who do I get defensive in front of? People that are attacking me. Okay? And so you usually show the worst side of yourself to your critics. It's amazing. The very people you want to show the best side of yourself to, you show the worst side of yourself to because they're attacking you. And then you get defensive. And it's not wise what you say. If you look back to almost everything you've said and trying to defend yourself and people criticizing you and that, it would have been far better to have kept your mouth shut during that period of time than what you said. But keep in mind, Jesus Christ said, "I am meek." It's one of his statements. What's that mean? It means that when people come up and say things to him, he's not going to answer back. In fact, Pilate marveled over it. Marveled. You know, if you've ever had authority over people, now you women understand that, you know, you've raised little brats, you know, and little kids. All right? And yeah, let's keep getting there like we were this morning. All right? But you raise little kids, and you know, when they're in trouble and you're walking in, what do they do? You know, they swear they didn't do it. They beg for forgiveness. And they do everything. And they blame each other. And so I had a brother that could fill his drawers and blame the other brother. And that's the true thing. Hank did it. You know, that wasn't me. Hank did it. His name was Frank, but he couldn't say anything. Hank did it, he'd say. And, you know, but the thing is, they do that. And they're blurting because they're in trouble. You know, cop pulls somebody over and they've already got too many points on their license. It's like, woo, you know, they're begging and they don't want this to happen. Go further. It's embarrassing. If you've ever sat in traffic court and heard some of the idiots talking to the judge, it's embarrassing sometimes the things that people tell judges. Well, you know, my mother, and the judge, you know, look at them like, what? And, you know, you realize the great patience judges must have sometimes. So imagine if you had the power to have people crucified. Imagine that. Now, we all know crucifixion is an awful death. There's court cases where men actually fought for the right to be beheaded rather than be crucified. They're on record, the Roman records, where men fought for the right to be beheaded rather than spend 3 days on a cross or a slow death of crucifixion. So here you are, you're Pontius Pilate, and men walk in, you're a little annoyed, they bring in a couple of guys, and you know, you've been sitting there drinking wine, talking with the governors and things, and in comes this guy, you listen to it, and ask him his side of it, you take a few moments, say, crucify him. Okay? Now, what do you think Pilate's heard when he said that? He's heard men plead. He's heard men beg. He's heard men curse him going out the door. And here stands a man in front of him who says nothing. And it says Pilate marveled over that. Marveled. And when he asked him about it, Jesus Christ said, "You could have no power over me at all except my Father gave it to you." Okay. Now that's the definition of meekness. Moses was said to be more meek than any man of the earth. That's what it says about him. What's that mean? It means when his brother and sister went up and accused him of something, he didn't answer. He let God handle it. And to be honest with you, they'd have been a lot better off if Moses had handled it. Okay? It wasn't pretty when God handled it. And so, if you'll keep this in mind, number one, if you're being attacked by someone and they're accusing you, and I'm going to give you an exception here in a bit. If someone's accusing you of something, if it's not true, chances are there's nothing you can say during this accusation to prove otherwise. If it's a fair counsel or a court or something, you might have a chance to do it. But if it's just a bunch of friends arguing, a church or a family, you know, to get together, there's chances are there's nothing you can say. And if you do talk, chances are you'll only dig a deeper hole and convince half the people you're more guilty than they thought you were in the first place. Okay? So just shut up. We say, well, I'll probably cry. Then cry. Be good to cry. Cry. Okay? Let it be on their conscience that you stood there and cried while they said that stuff, while they think about it. Okay? So let's say it's true what they're saying, but it's twisted somehow, a little warped. You know, those are the things that hurt the worst. When somebody says something true about you, but it's a little bit twisted and warped, and you really want to straighten that out because it's true what they're saying, but you don't understand the circumstances here. Again, if you get involved, it'll only look worse when you're done. Okay? It's not going to be pretty, you jumping in right now. So just sit there, if tears come out of your eyes, just sit there and be quiet, let it go. A, the worst thing they can do is aggravate the Lord with what they're saying. The best way to keep the Lord from being aggravated is for you to jump in and try to defend yourself. Then he backs out. You don't want to be involved in this. It's two idiots arguing. He's not interested in who's right and who's wrong. You know, I looked up the Queen of England's address the other day, and they had a thing about the letters she doesn't want. And it says, don't write her letters asking to get involved in family arguments. And you can imagine the Queen of England in her 90 years has gotten many, you know, many letters from people. Well, you tell mine, it's just there, you know. And such. She doesn't want to get involved in it. Well, God doesn't want to get involved in it, if you really want to know. If the Queen of England doesn't, you can be sure God doesn't want to. So the thing is, but nothing pricks God's heart more than to see a defenseless person being ridden. Just shut up and let God handle it. You say, well, what if it's true? Then just take what's said and be quiet, and it'll go away quicker when you shut your mouth than you run in your mouth, a lot quicker. So with Jesus Christ, they're saying things. Now, what's the exception? Well, Kyle's about to go take over a new store in Greece. He's about to take over an Old Navy there. And when he comes in, he's not going to know who's his friends and who's his enemies. Okay? There's going to be somebody in that store that's jealous and thinks really they should be the manager there, but they brought in a guy from outside who will smile and shake Kyle's hand, you know, and such. And, hey, we'll work together and such. But we'll do every little thing he can to undermine him in teeny little ways. We've all been at workplaces. Isn't there always someone who does that? Sure there is. Always some little squirrel who undermines in little teeny ways like that. Now, here's what the difference is. If someone makes an accusation against Kyle about his professional management of the store, don't let it rest. You absolutely, your management of that store, you prove it's what it ought to be. And if it turns out that you're wrong, they made a mistake, you go to them and say, thank you for pointing this out, okay? I owe you for this, all right? And you get it. But if it comes down to some personal thing about you, you know, he picks his nose, just shut up, leave it alone. They have personal things to say about you. Now, let's say that somebody's running their mouth on Jim. And, okay, they're running their mouth on Jim. If they're running it as a man, now, I'd be upset with you. The best thing Jim can do is let it go. But if someone runs their mouth on him as a trustee of the church, it needs to be handled, okay? Paul said this, I magnify mine office. You could run your mouth on Paul all you wanted as a man. If you run your mouth on him as an apostle, he's going to step in. There's a difference there, okay? And so knowing that difference, understanding that difference, don't defend your own person. There is a God in heaven, and he will defend you. It may not be on the schedule you want. It may not be with the exact lightning bolt that you dial up, okay? But he will defend you. And if you'll look back a year or two later, when you handle it right, for maybe the first time in your life, okay, and you handle it right, and you look back a year or two later, you'll be very satisfied with how it turned out. I guarantee you that. You really will. You'll be satisfied. But if it comes to something you're professionally doing, you know, something that's your office, something you're to do, then you do need to get involved. You do need to defend that. And then ask God to help you handle it right, and don't get sucked into the personal things. Don't let that happen, okay? You may find, like I may find, that there's somebody there who doesn't like him personally, but has tremendous skills that will make that store run better. Part of Kyle's professionalism will be utilizing that person, ignoring the personal. A lot of managers can't ignore the personal, and as a result, they can't run a shop. Because they can't ignore it. you yourself, you're Teflon. They can say all they want about you personally. It doesn't matter. Look, the guy does his job. He's doing what he's supposed to. There's the famous thing where they came to Abraham Lincoln about Grant. And they talk, and he drinks, and he cusses, and he smokes cigars, and he does this, and he does that. And Lincoln got done. He said, yeah, but he fights. He does exactly what he's supposed to, and we're going to keep him. And it was a good decision. Now, with that said, a little departure from the text here, but back to Matthew chapter 12. Verse 14, then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him. But when Jesus knew it, he withdrew himself from thence, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all, and charged them that they should not make him known. Now, isn't that interesting? You'd think with them running their mouth, he'd want everyone, look, go show what happened when you followed me. But he said, no, don't tell anybody. Just be quiet about it. Why? He's meek. He's not trying to thrust himself forward. But look what it says here, verse 17, that it might be fulfilled that which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him. He shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. So, again, it tells you, why did he withdraw them out there? Why did he tell them to be quiet? He did it so the prophecy would be fulfilled. It said he did it that it might be fulfilled. When you get to studying the fulfillment of prophecy, you'll realize that prophecy never happens because God figured it out ahead of time. It happens because God ordered it to happen. God said, this will happen. Okay? That's what happened. Now, go to the book of Zechariah. By the way, it's only two books before Matthew. If you go back two books, the book before Matthew is Malachi, the one before that is Zechariah. Zechariah 9. By the way, I'll tell you something about leadership also. This will affect Kyle, and we'll pick on him a moment. Imagine walking in again to this store, and here's people who wanted the store, people, you know, all this kind of stuff. He's coming in, and he doesn't really know who's who and all that kind of stuff. But Kyle strikes me as a man who has always been able to take orders. In other words, what he was told to do, he's done. He's done it like he's supposed to. Such a person makes a good leader. If you have a rebel, somebody who doesn't follow orders, fights against it, bucks orders everywhere they can, they don't make a good leader. God forbid you ever have to be in a position to follow a person like that. They don't respect authority, therefore when they have it, they can't utilize it. They can't make it work. Jim, you've been at the workplace how long? You know, that guy that's quiet, can always take orders. When he's in charge, he quietly gets orders, and he knows exactly how to make it work. You find the young punk that was always a bit smarter and knew how to do things, and finally he's given a chance to run things. He'll turn a good place into a hellhole in about 5 seconds, okay? Because that's all he's ever been, is just a rebel, and he doesn't know how to run things. Therefore, he runs his mouth on everybody who does know how to run things. So, Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly, riding upon an ass and upon a colt, the foal of an ass. So this is one of the prophecies about Jesus Christ. So the thing is this a prophecy because God looked into the future and saw Jerusalem that day? How are we going to get Jesus there? Oh, there's an ass. You know, maybe, oh, he'll get on that. Now, I think that's what he'll do. No, that is not why he prophesied that. So go to Matthew chapter 21. Look at verse 1. And when they drew nigh unto Jerusalem and were come to Bethpage, unto the Mount of Olives, then sent Jesus 2 disciples, saying unto them, Go into the village over against you, and straightway ye shall find an ass tied and a colt with her. Loose them and bring them unto me. Okay. And if any man say aught unto you, you shall say, The Lord hath need of them, and straightway he shall send. Verse 4. Why was this done? All this was done that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, saying, Tell ye the daughter of Sion, Behold, thy king cometh unto thee, meek, and sitting upon an ass, and a colt, the foal of an ass. Okay. So again, how did prophecy happen there? Well, God commanded the future to be exactly like he wanted it to be. And the day came when Jesus Christ told the disciples, you will go, this is what you will find, because God the Father commanded it to happen. Therefore, we're going to do it exactly that way. So when we go to the book of Revelation and we read, that's not God ciphering out how it's going to happen because he's more clever than us. That's God commanding the future to be there. That's God's command. The devil will show up at Armageddon, and he will fight God as the Antichrist. Okay? Say, well, why would he do that? It's written that he's going to lose. It's what's called corrupted wisdom. Now, what is corrupted wisdom? Well, if you've ever been young, you probably know what corrupted wisdom is because you practiced it. You know, you get your first credit card. You're told, you know, when you get that credit card, you only buy things that you can pay for and pay it off and such. And yet, you know, you find yourself going to the store and, gosh, I need that new dress. Now, you know that you can't make big payments on a credit card. You know that if you can't afford that dress right now, you really shouldn't get it. But your lust told you, swipe through, get that dress, okay? And so you get it. But yet you know that you can't afford a big credit card payment. You know that. You're wise enough to know that. But what's corrupting your wisdom? Your lusts are corrupting your wisdom. So then comes a chance to, you know, have a good night at a restaurant. Gosh, you know, my wife and I really need the night at the restaurant tonight and such. And you know you can't handle a big credit card bill, but your lust tells you to do this, and you swipe that credit card. And, you know, suddenly the bill comes in and it's more than you can pay this month. You vowed to yourself you'd pay it off every month, okay? You weren't going to pay interest payments. But suddenly you owe $232 on this and your budget's only going to allow you to pay $95. So you pay $95, you say, well, I'll take care of it next month. The next month another lust comes along. Boom, you jump into that, okay? So it's what's called corrupted wisdom. You know that where you're going is the wrong way, but you can't stop yourself because individual little lusts are doing that. Okay? You know what? I want to go out that door. But I just want to talk to Chris first. I want to go out that door, but I need to talk to Jody first. I want to go out that door, but I think I need to go talk to Rich a little bit. But I want to go out that door. Gosh, it looks pretty nice over there. So eventually what happens? I keep telling you I'm going that way, but every step I'm taking is taking me that way. Now, how many young people do we know we watch like that? Okay? Their mouth tells you where they're trying to go, but you watch every step of their feet and it's taking them the exact opposite direction. That's what's called corrupted wisdom. They're not stupid. They just, something's corrupting their wisdom. Individual lusts on a momentary basis are interrupting that. So the thing is, why will the devil show up at Armageddon? Because his wisdom is corrupt. His individual lusts will make him be there. And finally think that he can beat the God of glory in one-on-one combat, and he won't win. He's going to be defeated. He'll be destroyed there. It's commanded that he will come. It's commanded that he'll do that. That's what prophecy is. Last one we'll look at. Go to Psalm 22. I was just reading Ecclesiastes this morning. It says, a dream is fulfilled by a multitude of business. What's that mean? You have a dream. How do you get it done? Get busy. Make it work. Get involved. But a fool is known by a multitude of words. They just talk about the dreams. Okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And it tells you, that's how you know what a fool is. They're talking, but they're not doing it. So the thing is, the person who wants to get involved and get their dream done works on it. You say, well, what I'm working at keeps failing. That's part of the learning process. The great Japanese industrialist Suzuki said this, success is 99% failure. Meaning if you look at a successful person, you'll find failure after failure after failure after failure. But in every failure, they're learning, they get back into it. I've been reading a book here recently on the Wright brothers. And the thing that's so remarkable about the Wright brothers is just what hard-working two people they were, who just labored and labored and labored, who just worked and worked and worked. And just every little thing that they needed, they just worked and worked and did it themselves. Finally, they're getting ready to go to France and sell this machine to the French government. They tried to sell it to the U.S. government, nobody would believe it. So finally, they go to France to sell to the French government, but they have to work in a factory to kind of put some things together that got damaged. And later the workers in that factory were amazed at these two Americans, how they worked in that factory, how they came in there and just labored every day, right, with the other workers and such. And it was such a testimony about them as people. But see, dreams are known by the multitude of business. Fools are known by the multitude of words. So, with that as an aside, Psalm chapter 22, look at verse 18. This is a prophecy of Jesus Christ on the cross. They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. So one of the prophecies about him is while he's on the cross, they're going to be divvying up what he has. And then we know they cast lots upon his vesture because he had something they didn't want to tear apart. So they, rather than everybody take a little bit of cloth, they said, well, let's just cast lots for it. Now go with me to Matthew 27, and we'll end up here. Matthew chapter 27. Look at verse 35. And they crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots. Why did they do that? That it might be fulfilled that which was spoken by the prophet. They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. Now here's these Roman soldiers. They don't even realize. Why'd you guys end up with some dice and end up gambling over that one piece? Because it'd been ordered by God. Something was demanded by God 700 years earlier, and you're just fulfilling it. You're just fulfilling what God said to do. Now, why do I say that? I say that so that you yourselves understand prophecy, how it works. Prophecy ain't God figuring it out. That's how men prophesy, and that's why our prophecies are so weak. Once in a while, they're right. And then when they are, we lord it over everybody, no matter how often we're wrong. It's just the way we are. Remember, I told you to take your umbrella to work, you know, and it rained on you and such. And that's always good enough to make them obey you for 10 years after that, no matter how often they're wrong. That's just how people are, okay? You know, somebody will get the stock market right. I knew Apple would crash, and usually when you follow that person later, they don't get anything else right. That's just one of the things you see. But everybody runs to them on the next thing. Well, that's usually the worst person to run to. You know, you have to use your own judgment. But God's prophecies aren't that way. God's prophecies are him ordering it to happen, and it happens. That's what his prophecies are. All right, let's close. Father, I thank you for the chance to be in the house of God today. We do pray that you would bless our day. And Lord, I pray for Mrs. Haynes feeling a little...